All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am joined by the publisher of Pewter Report, Scott Reynolds, and we're going to be taking a deeper look into Dirk Cutter's offense and how he's going to fit in Atlanta.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years at FalcFans.com, on Twitter at FalcFans, and of course, I am the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today, I am joined by the publisher of Pewter Report, longtime beat writer for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Scott Reynolds. We had Scott on this past July to sort of preview the Buccaneers season. I don't recall too much of what that conversation went like, but I do remember that we talked quite a bit about Jameis Winston and sort of a make and break year. And, you know, maybe we'll get Scott's thought on whether Jameis lived up to that. But anyway, without further ado, welcome back to the show, Scott.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you this evening?
I'm excellent. You guys got a pretty good coach coming your way in Dirk Cutter, who will be back in Atlanta as the offensive coordinator, a role that he was familiar with under Mike Smith several years ago, and then that led to him becoming the Buccaneers offensive coordinator in 2015 during Jameis Winston's rookie year. And then the head coach for the last 3 years when he replaced Lovie Smith. So, he stays within the NFC South, the division he's very familiar with, and back in Atlanta as the OC.
Yeah, we've been spending a lot of time on this podcast trying to discuss some of the reasons why the Falcons hired Dirk Cutter, some of the reasons why the Falcons decided to move on from Steve Sarkisian, their former offensive coordinator. But I do want to jump right in to sort of talking about Dirk Cutter. I've been sort of a vocal critic of this hire simply due to the fact that from his days previously in Atlanta, I wasn't a huge fan of his offense. I thought it was a little bit too vanilla. I thought it relied a little bit too much on dinking and dunking and sort of the developments that have happened under Dan Quinn, which has been a little bit more of an explosive offense, relying heavily off of play action, which wasn't necessarily a hallmark of the Falcons offense during the Cutter years. But I want to get your thoughts on, maybe I'm just a little too biased, basing my opinions off of what are now five-year-old opinions and trying to get an idea of sort of what Dirk Cutter has done in his years in Tampa Bay. If you could tell me, you know, in your own words, sort of what were some of the bullet points? What were some of the main hallmarks of the Cutter offense during his tenure in Tampa Bay?
Well, I think that the Dirk likes to play action game and he likes to take shots down the field. And I think that kind of evolved a little bit from, you know, from the days in Atlanta when Julio Jones was much younger. But now when you look at what Atlanta has to work with, and not just Julio Jones as a receiver that can get down the field, but also now Calvin Ridley, Dirk Cutter's big on explosive plays. He wants those chunk plays in the passing game. And let's face it, in Tampa, he's had that with receivers like Mike Evans, DeSean Jackson, and Chris Godwin, who's really kind of an emerging receiver within the league. And also to the tight ends with Cam Brate and OJ Howard, those are staples in the red zone. And I think for a tight end like Austin Hooper, who I think had a pretty good year this year with 71 catches for 660 yards and four touchdowns. Austin Hooper's not going anywhere in Dirk Cutter's offense. The tight end is definitely a featured position, so he's still going to be, you know, getting his share of catches in Atlanta. And I think that the one thing Dirk did well was really spread the ball around, and I think that's something that Atlanta has with so many weapons, whether it's Julio Jones or Mohamed Sanu or Calvin Ridley or Austin Hooper, is making sure that the ball gets spread around a lot. And I think on any given Sunday, even a receiver like Justin Hardy can step up and be the guy. We saw that in Tampa with Adam Humphries, the slot receiver, lead the way on a couple of occasions when the opponents were maybe taking Mike Evans away or OJ Howard. So I think that Cutter's offense is pretty diverse and it'll get everybody involved, and he likes guys that can catch the ball out of the backfield. And I think that plays well. We'll see what happens, with Tevin Coleman, who was probably in that role last year as the receiving back. If he ends up staying in Atlanta, I think he's a free agent. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah. So, you know, if Coleman comes back, he'll have a big role because Dirk Koetter likes to throw the ball to the back side of the backfield, and not saying that Devonta Freeman can't do that, but that was kind of the role that Coleman had in Atlanta, and if he ends up staying as a Falcon, I would suspect that he'll catch quite a few passes out of the backfield as well. So I think spreading the ball around, taking shots down the field off play action, getting the tight end involved, those are some of the strengths. I think maybe the weakness was the red zone play calling. That really has kind of been a thorn in the buck side for the last couple of years. And even though Dirk Koetter gave the play calling duties to Todd Monken this year, he did have, you know, kind of he was pulling the strings as the puppet master on offense and still being heavily involved in what those play calls were. So I think that if Todd Monken dialed up a play that Dirk Koetter didn't like, Dirk had the ability to overrule the play and change to something else. I want to say that happened, you know, quite a bit, maybe from the mid-season part of the season on down the stretch when Koetter's job was really on the line. But I think that the red zone play calling was a big deal, and I know that's been an issue in Atlanta from time to time. But he does have a good relationship with Matt Ryan. I think Matt Ryan's probably a better red zone quarterback than Jameis Winston. Certainly just more experienced for sure. And, you know, I would suspect that Matt Ryan will still continue to enjoy those 4,000-yard seasons and throwing the ball quite a bit in Atlanta.
Well, Scott and I are going to continue to take a deeper look at this Dirk Koetter offense on today's podcast, but I do want to take a moment to remind you guys that while the Falcons season is over, the NFL playoffs are still going strong. And if you want to know what's going down this weekend in the conference championship games, you definitely want to check out the Locked On NFL podcast with host Matt Williamson. Today you can get Matt's picks on who's going to win this weekend, and then on Monday you can get Matt and the local experts' assessment of what went wrong or right for all four of the remaining playoff teams. Find the Locked On NFL podcast wherever you get your Locked On podcast, your team every day. Now, I'm joined by Scott Reynolds, publisher of PewterReport.com, talking about Dirk Koetter. And I'm one topic of constant conversation, because I've been inundated with questions about people wondering how is the run game going to be integrated into this offense. The Falcons have been pretty predominantly a outside zone blocking scheme over these last couple of years with Dan Quinn. That necessarily hasn't been a huge hallmark of the Dirk Koetter offense dating back to his days in Atlanta. I'm curious, sort of, did you see a sort of diversity in the Bucs run scheme that would make you feel confident that Dirk Koetter will have little to no issue running sort of this outside zone scheme that Kyle Shanahan, his father, made famous in places like Denver?
Well, I think Dirk Koetter wanted to do a lot of outside zone stuff in Tampa, just didn't have the offensive linemen or the running backs that were capable of that. As a matter of fact, a lot of the tosses and outside zone stuff they tried to run just really kind of infuriated Buccaneer fans because they were kind of wasted plays. And I understand sometimes you have to mix it up, but I think that with Tampa Bay's personnel, the inside man-blocking schemes really work best for this personnel. But that's not necessarily where Dirk wanted to run the ball. It's just that's kind of what the Buccaneers did well, is between the tackle type runs with Peyton Barber and the offensive line, which was really built more for the power run game than it was for the zone stuff. So I think that Atlanta maybe having the athletes on the offensive line and the running backs to maybe pull that off will continue to do that, because that's something he tried to force down the Buccaneers' throats, but really without much success here. The running game was really one of the league's worst last year, and I know that Dirk likes balance, and I think sometimes they ran the ball too much just because Dirk wanted to achieve that balance, and a lot of those were just wasted downs, wasted runs because of the inept blocking. And I think part of that was due to George Warhop, the offensive line coach. It just wasn't getting the most out of the offensive line, and therefore they didn't do a good job opening up holes. It just kind of dominoed from there. But I think ideally Dirk does like to have a balanced offense, so I think that as long as he can stay healthy, Devonta Freeman should thrive as a guy that can not just run outside, but maybe between the tackles a bit and also catch some screen passes and be effective on the perimeter.
Now, I'm also curious about sort of the relationship between Dirk Koetter and Jameis Winston. You know, Winston notably was inconsistent. There were, you know, the highs were very high. Falcon fans know from firsthand experience the ridiculous numbers that Jameis Winston would routinely put up against the Falcons. But then you also sort of experienced the lows with a bunch of turnovers. I'm curious to sort of get your thoughts on sort of that relationship. You know, I know there was a point in 2017 where Jameis was vocal critic of sort of maybe the predictability of Dirk Koetter's offense. But I'm curious, sort of looking at that relationship, do you feel like one part of that relationship held the other back a little bit more? Is it a case of Dirk Koetter's offense could have flourished a little bit more from 2015 to 2017 if Jameis had been a little bit more consistent? Or do you think some of Jameis's inconsistencies were due to some of the limitations that maybe the offense put on him?
Well, I think that the underlying problem for Dirk and Jameis was just the amount of turnovers. Jameis was just careless with the ball and threw a lot of interceptions, and that led to his benching this past year. And it also led to Dirk Koetter not being the Buccaneers head coach anymore. Interceptions will kill a coach. If you're a quarterback, throws a lot of picks, you're going to kill the coach. And I think ultimately that's what happened. I think Dirk is going to do much better with a quarterback that already understands and has demonstrated the ability to not kill you with turnovers. You look at Matt Ryan's touchdowns to interceptions last year, 35-7. I mean, that's a healthy number. And I think that Dirk didn't do the best job developing Jameis Winston, but I think he's going to do better with a more veteran quarterback who kind of already understands what it's like to be a professional, what it means to protect the football. And I think that while Dirk was trying to teach Jameis algebra, Matt Ryan's already kind of on to trigonometry. And I think that's going to just jive better with Dirk Koetter. I think the reason why Dirk lost the team was because he expected everybody just to kind of be a professional. And I think Dirk's a very professional head coach with a somewhat complicated offense and kind of expected everybody to grasp it. And when you've got veterans on this team like Matt Ryan and, Mohamed Sanu and Julio Jones, Austin Hooper, those type of players that kind of get it because they've been in the league, I think that they're going to do okay. I think where Dirk struggled was with the young players, whether it be offensive linemen, whether it be wide receivers, whether it be the quarterback, just understanding what it means to be a pro. I think Dirk was really better suited as an offensive coordinator than he was as a head coach. It's not to say that the guys tuned him out. They liked Dirk. They did. It's just that it's hard to expect young guys, whether you're 21, 22, 23, coming into the league to just automatically get it and be professionals. And I think that was kind of one of his downfalls as a leader in Tampa. But he's going to a Falcons offense that's got a lot of veterans on it. And I think they're going to be able to pick it up quickly and be able to flourish. And I think the other thing Dirk brings from a positive standpoint is just the fact that he's been entrenched in the NFC South. He studied the Falcons twice a year. He studied the Saints twice a year. He studied the Panthers twice a year. He knows the Buccaneers personnel on defense. It's going to have a different scheme this year with Todd Bowles as the defensive coordinator and under Bruce Arians, but I think just that overall familiarity will allow him to kind of hit the ground running a little bit in Atlanta. And I think maybe that might have been one of the reasons why he took the Falcons job over, say, the Vikings offensive coordinator job, is just that familiarity. It's going to help him in Atlanta kind of fast track some success there. If there is maybe one detriment as a play caller, and we've kind of seen it over the last couple of years, it's from an offensive standpoint, he fires a lot of bullets in the first half of the season, and the offense doesn't really evolve. And maybe towards the end of the season, you don't have a reloading situation. In other words, I don't know that he adapts very well and keeps the playbook fresh throughout the season. And that might be something to keep an eye on is you might see some tremendous offensive output and some big time numbers and some big time wins early in the season. But then as defenses adjust throughout the season and there's more and more and more game film, I think that, that the offense does become more predictable during the season. And that's one thing I think Dirk's going to have to really be mindful of is his record in December was not good as, you know, as an offense that if you look last year, Tampa Bay's offense, again, even though Todd Monken was calling the plays, we didn't see the playbook really kind of evolve. And it just seemed like they were trying to continue what was working early in the season. And you saw the offensive rankings and the passing game and points scored and offense, you know, offensive yards per game just diminish as the season went on.
That's an interesting point there, Scott, because it sort of triggered a memory of mine from the 2012 season in Atlanta, which was Cutter's best here in Atlanta as the offensive coordinator, where the Falcons started that season, I think, 8-0 or 7-0, and Matt Ryan was sort of being considered an MVP candidate. And then the second half of the season, his production sort of dipped and trailed off quite a bit. And so, you know, maybe that is a reason for sort of that sort of dichotomy between the highs and the lows, even back then. So to see that sort of continue with Dirk Cutter in Tampa, and that was something that the Falcons experienced this past year under Steve Sarkisian, which, you know, it was a contribution to probably his dismissal, where they sort of went into this dip after their bye week for five games and really struggled to score points. I think they averaged about like 17 or 18 points a game, when earlier in the season they were averaging, you know, at least 10 points more than that. So that'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on if that sort of trend continues in 2019. So there's more to come on today's episode, but the NFL season may be winding down to the end, but the NBA season is still going strong with the trade deadline approaching. See who may be dealt over the next 3 weeks by checking out any one of the podcasts on the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find a daily podcast devoted to all 30 NBA teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with host Brad Rowland. Find it wherever you get your Locked On podcasts, your NBA team every day. Now, Scott, one of the last points I want to get to about this Cutter offense is sort of, you mentioned with Todd Monken taking over play calling, and now he's going to be, where did he wind up in? I can't remember, which all these coaching changes, it's got me confused.
Yeah, he actually, he got several considerations. He was going to possibly be the offensive coordinator with the New York Jets, but Matt Rhule, the Baylor head coach, really wanted to bring in his own staff, but Monken finished second. Since Rhule didn't take the job, they went with Adam Gase just because of the head coaching experience. But Monken was really well thought of by the Jets organization. He actually ended up going to the Cleveland Browns organization, where he'll be the offensive coordinator under Freddie Kitchens and work with Baker Mayfield. So I think Todd Monken's a very up-and-coming play caller, and I think that Dirk did a really good job of kind of mentoring him, giving him that opportunity in the preseason to call the plays. And when Monken did a phenomenal job in the preseason, Cutter decided to stick with him as the play caller. Again, there were a couple instances. The Redskins game was one of those where Monken was basically relegated to just being an assistant, and Cutter took over the entire play calling for the Redskins game. The Bucs put up over 500 yards of offense on the Redskins, but came away with just 3 points. They really bogged down inside the red zone. And I think there were other instances where Cutter stepped in and took over the play calling for a series or a quarter, just really didn't let the media know about it. But you could kind of sense a difference from the late season play calling and the early season play calling. And, you know, again, Dirk Cutter did a good job in trusting Monken to call those plays. But I think when the season was on the line, Dirk Cutter's job was on the line, I think he was more influential in those play calling decisions down the stretch.
So I was curious to see sort of just as a way of maybe further defining sort of Dirk Cutter's tendencies, what were some of the things that you thought Todd Monken did differently that sort of led to the Bucs offense sort of showing the improvement that they showed this year? At least from my perspective, watching the Bucs, particularly early in the season, it seemed like the play action and the deep ball were a big part of their offense and a big reason why they were able to generate more explosive plays and potentially led to, you know, a greater scoring output this season. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Monka was not afraid to call shots down the field early and often, and he would do that with play action. And we're not just talking about the 20 and 30-yard intermediate strikes. We're talking about the deep ball, 50-yard pass that ends up turning into a 75-yard catch-and-run situation, whether it be Mike Evans, whether it be DeSean Jackson. Those were the big-time shots that Monken liked to take. I think Cutter will take those, especially with the guy that can really stretch the field in Calvin Ridley. And certainly Julio Jones can do that as well when healthy. But I really believe that Monken maybe called a little bit more aggressive game plans than Cutter. Cutter was just maybe a touch more conservative and would settle more for those intermediate 20 and 30 yard chunks, where sometimes Monken would want to go for the jugular and get the 70 yard touchdown strike. And I think too, that once defenses really adjusted to that and played a lot more cover two and took away some of those deep passes, I don't think that the Buccaneers were as creative in trying to go for those two-beater plays that are, you know, basically the shots down the seam on the sidelines between the corner underneath and the safety over the top. I think that once teams really got away from playing the single high safety and man coverage, the offense bogged down a little bit with either a cover two defense with zone underneath or even more importantly, the cover two defense with man under. That was really a scheme that really gave at least Jameis Winston, the Bucs passing attack, fits. Now, we'll see if Matt Ryan, a more veteran quarterback, knows how to handle that. And I think he will.
The last question I want to ask you, Scott, is there's been a lot of talk and rumors about the potential departure of Gerald McCoy, who's long been a fixture on that Bucs defense, has been sort of their franchise player. If you can call a defensive player, he certainly has sort of lived up to that over the years in Tampa Bay since they drafted him way back in 2010. And there's been talk of sort of him among several other sort of key veterans that may be getting pushed out the door this offseason. From my perspective, and I'll give you that before I let you answer, but it just seems to not make much sense to me to get rid of your arguably your best defensive player. And if he's not number one, he's number two behind maybe Lavonte David or Quan Alexander, to save some cap space when you can get rid of a bunch of other players that are far less valuable people like Mitch Unrein and William Golston to free up equal or a similar amount of cap space. But I am curious sort of how much you think the whole idea of Gerald McCoy getting cut has legs, because Falcon fans are sort of eagerly looking at, is Gerald McCoy going to get cut? We can scoop him up and he can solve a lot of the defensive tackle issues that the Falcons have. They're also sort of looking at Thomas Davis, who's not going to be back in Carolina. So it seems like Falcons fans, at least, are hoping to raid the rest of the NFC South for some of their sort of key veteran playmakers. And I'm curious, sort of, what are your thoughts on at least Gerald McCoy and whether or not he's played his last game in Tampa Bay?
I think he has because of his high cap value at $13 million. For a player who really has really gotten banged up the last couple of years and has not played a full 16 games in several seasons. Gerald's going to be 31 years old in February. And I just think that you're at the point of diminishing returns now, especially for that salary. And Tampa Bay, over the last couple of years, because they've been such a young team, has really been flush with salary cap space. And this is really the first year after mega extensions for Mike Evans and the right guard or the left guard, Ali Marpet, and signing a player like Ryan Jensen, who is now the highest paid center in the league, and re-signing Cameron Brate to his big deal. And then you're looking at the fifth year option for Jameis Winston occupying about $21 million in cap space. Whereas the last couple of years on that rookie contract, Jameis has been, you know, under $5 million. I think that now Tampa Bay, which has gone from a flush salary cap situation to I believe now heading into 2019, they have the fifth least cap room at just about $17 million worth of cap space available right now. And of course, they could make some moves to quickly chop off $50, $60 million and really kind of swing the momentum back towards having a lot more cap space. But the players right now that are not under contract for the Bucks include left tackle Donovan Smith, who will probably end up making between $13 to $14 million per season. Quan Alexander, their middle linebacker, who's coming off a torn ACL, which kind of muddies the water for him a little bit in terms of free agency and what he's going to be able to get. And also Adam Humphries, the slot receiver who ended up, I think, being the second leading receiver in Tampa behind Mike Evans. He's a very valuable target in this offense, one of Jameis Winston's go-to guys. So those three players are going to command some big-time cap room that the Bucs just don't have right now. I think Tampa Bay is going to have to part ways with DeSean Jackson. That frees up $10 million. Parting ways with Gerald McCoy frees up $13 million. So you've got $23 million right there in cap room waiting to be had. Add that into the $17 million. Now you're up to $30 million in cap space, and that allows you the flexibility to re-sign those players and maybe have enough for your draft pool. But Tampa Bay is going to want to add some more players too. So they're going to have to really kind of do some salary cap carving for the first time in a long time and make some guys salary cap cash these. And I just think if you look at Gerald McCoy, the production just hasn't been there. It's six sacks over the past two seasons, or I should say each of the past two seasons. And I think his age, the amount of punishment he's taken over the last couple of years, I just don't think he's worth $13 million, whether it be in Tampa or Atlanta or anywhere else in the league. I think he'll be hard-pressed to command that. And also, too, what type of fit will he have in Todd Bowles' defense, which is more of a 3-4 scheme? Bowles can make it flexible, and he can play some four-man fronts, and Gerald's still a guy that can attack one gap and make some plays. But I think that when you look at the hierarchy, I think Jason Pierre-Paul is clearly the best defensive player in Tampa with 12 and a half sacks this year. And then Lavonte David probably second. And then, third, I think you're looking at Gerald McCoy, Quan Alexander, and even Carl Nassib, the defensive end who was acquired off waiver wires, claimed off waiver wires from Cleveland. He had 6.5 sacks in a breakout year playing opposite Jason Pierre-Paul. So I think Gerald's kind of sliding down the Bucks' totem pole on defense. And I don't know that there's that much of a strong desire to keep him in Tampa, especially if the Bucks are going to be going to a more of a 3-4 scheme under Todd Bowles.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Scott, I appreciate your insights. I think you gave a lot of them, causing me to sort of reevaluate my assessment of Dirk Koetter, as well as the potential possibility of landing Gerald McCoy. So I appreciate you coming on, and I hope maybe I'll get an opportunity to talk with you later this summer after the Bucs and Falcons and all these NFC South teams have made their offseason moves, and we can sort of do what we did last summer and sort of take a look ahead to sort of what are some of the big storylines involving the Tampa Bay Bucks under new head coach Bruce Arians going into 2019. Does that sound good?
Yeah, it sounds like a plan. I always enjoy talking with you, Aaron. You guys do a great job covering the Falcons, and always happy to come on and talk some NFC South football with you.
Well, Scott, go ahead, and before you get out of here, go ahead, plug Pewter Report and sort of what other sort of things you guys got coming up this offseason.
Well, I know Falcon fans are really dialed into their team, and rightly so, but if you're looking for coverage of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and you want to keep an eye on the NFC South rival that Atlanta has in Tampa Bay, you can log on to PewterReport.com. We also cover the draft exceptionally well. And you can also follow us on Twitter at PewterReport. So encourage all the Falcon fans out there to check us out, not just twice a year for when the Bucs play the Falcons, but also in the offseason, too, to keep an eye on what Tampa Bay is doing.
Absolutely. All right, Scott, I appreciate you coming on, and I hope you have a good night, and good luck to you over at Pewter Report. I look forward to your guys' coverage. Trevor Sikkema, one of your guys, is a member of the Locked On Podcast Network, so I always enjoy checking out his work at Pewter Report as well as some of your other many talented writers.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, man. Have a good one.
Yep. Enjoy your evening. Thanks. Right. Bye-bye.
You too. All right, guys. There you have it. Thanks to Scott for joining me. And look, you know, I've been very critical of the Cutter offense, and it seems like Scott was saying all the things, all the right things. You know, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the balanced rushing attack, but Dan Quinn is, hashtag physical. You know, play action passing, outside zone stuff. It seems like Cutter can do it. You know, we'll keep an eye on sort of the dichotomy between, you know, good first half of the season, bad second half of the season. That's sort of the criticism of him being a little bit too predictable, and not making adjustments, bears fruit. You know, I'll have to go back and revisit sort of my notes from 2012 to 2014 to see if that was a situation consistently in those years. But as I mentioned, you know, 2012, you can certainly make a case that maybe that was an issue. And then, of course, the Gerald McCoy thing, which I've sort of been thinking wasn't going to happen because it just seemed like, you know, a new coach coming in and basically, you know, taking this veteran player that's still a productive player, just maybe not as productive as he has been in previous years where he was a dominant force in the NFL, but certainly still one of the better defensive tackles in the league. And, you know, it sounds like from what Scott's saying that there is some legit reason to think that Gerald McCoy could get cut. And if he does, then he obviously becomes a potential candidate for this Falcons defense where you're looking for some veteran leadership on the defensive side of the ball. You know, we talked with Jeff Schultz of The Athletic earlier this week, and Jeff talked about sort of the lack of leadership in the Falcons locker room during this season, particularly on the defensive side of the ball due to the injuries and losing some key players like Ricardo Allen and Keon O'Neill and Deion Jones, and sort of missing that element. And certainly veteran players like Gerald McCoy, Thomas Davis, Brandon Graham, one of the reasons why the Falcons could potentially be attracted to them this offseason should they become available and should the Falcons decide to pursue those guys, is due to the fact that they can bring some veteran leadership to that side of the ball that you can argue, and certainly Jeff made a compelling case for, was very lacking from this defense last season. And I don't say that as if, like, I disagree with that statement. I think you can make a very strong case that the lack of leadership has been a major limiting factor for how good this defense can potentially be, even if that does mean taking on some over-the-hill, quote-unquote, over-the-hill players and contributors like a Gerald McCoy or Thomas Davis, et cetera. So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, before I was just kind of like, yeah, it's never going to happen. They're never going to cut Gerald McCoy. Maybe next year they'll cut him, but this year he's going to stay. Maybe not. You know, wouldn't be the first time I've been wrong about that. So, you know, basically this conversation with Scott, I have become a little bit more optimistic, a little bit more open to the possibility that Dirk Cutter will have some success in Atlanta as opposed to just simply being like, this is a terrible hire and I don't like it. And, you know, I'm still butthurt over the 2013 and 2014 seasons. So I will let that go and you know, we'll see. I'm not going to, you know me, I'm not going to be overwhelmingly positive. It's still early in the off season. But, you know, I think there's reason to be a little bit more optimistic after this conversation. So Monday, we will be back with another Q&A episode. For those of you guys that listened to earlier, or what was it, Wednesday's episode, I guess it was? Yeah, Wednesday's episode with Jeff Schultz. I mentioned Tack McKinley sort of had an issue, a run-in with the police. From everything that has been the updates now that, you know, of that sort of developing story at the time, Tack is doing fine. That's great. That's awesome. I know some of you asked questions about Tack for that Monday mailbag episode, but for those of you that haven't asked questions quite yet, you can do so on Twitter at Locked On Falcons. You can also do it on Facebook at Locked On Falcons. The email address is lockedonfalcons@mail.com. And of course, you can leave a comment at falcons.com. where the podcast is posted daily. So we'll be back Monday to talk more Falcons, more, you know, answering your listener questions. But until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.